as humans slaves to? Childhood traumas? What someone else decided we should be? An unfulfilling relationship? A job we don't like? Or the tedious routine of our lives? These are questions that are asked by today's guests, who we will meet in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. I am very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, Anand Dilwar, who is the author of The Slave, a spiritual manifesto for a better way of life. Anand, thank you so much for joining us on Mind Talk.
Hello, Pamela. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you heard me quote from your book. This is a book that has actually sold close to 2 million copies worldwide. Why do you think it's so popular? Do you think there's something particular going on in the world today that makes your book so important for people?
To tell you the truth, it was a great surprise for me how many books I have sold. We started here in Mexico, and we went to 1.2 million so very fast that it was obvious that something was going on. I think I was giving voice to something that it is happening inside of all of us and that needs to be expressed. There is a need to find answers within ourselves and stop blaming whatever it is outside for what's going wrong in our life. So there is, I think, a calling in all of us to move our view inward instead of looking outside for answers, looking in our relationships, in our luck, in the outside circumstances. There is, I think, a realization now that the answers will be found inside of us.
And in fact, that's where we have the most power, the most choice, the most options, is when we are looking within ourselves.
Yes, definitely. Well, we have this tendency to be looking for everything we need outside. There is an illusion, Pamela. There is this illusion that the happiness and peace is to be found outside in a set of circumstances, somewhere outside in the future. And we are like very busy trying to get there, trying to arrange things outside, arrange everything outside in a way that will make us feel happy and fulfilled. But now we're starting to realize that it is all the way around. We focus on the inside, and then everything outside starts taking its place. So I think that is a huge confusion right now, and we are like running like crazy towards something, some imaginary better future, and we are realizing that is not the way it is. No, that's not the solution.
And, you know, in large measure, I would suggest our media has a lot to do with that. I think about all the commercials that are constantly selling us something that if we just have that thing, it will change our lives forever. And I couldn't agree with you more. We spend so much time looking for, waiting for, preparing for that which is not in front of us at the moment, that we can actually miss out on much of our lives.
Yeah, there is an estimate that we spend 47% of our time lost in our minds. This time is used to remember the past or imagine the future. So all we have, the present moment, we missed completely. So, yeah, everything in society, it is arranged in a way that promises us fulfillment, peace, completion in the future. So we are always running after something that finally will complete us, that will finally make us feel satisfied and free.
You know, the title of your book is, at first blush, it's sort of jarring. You know, when I first looked at it, you know, I had a visceral reaction to the title. And then I saw this blue eye. And then I thought, wait a minute, what is going on here? And in fact, as you begin The Slave, a spiritual manifesto for a better way of life, you ask a very powerful, poignant question, which is, and I am quoting from your book, who has not been or isn't still a slave to problems, to fears, to guilt? And then all of a sudden, the whole concept made sense to me in a very different way. And it's a it's a very valid, valuable question.
Well, yeah, we really, I think that the big problem is that we look for our sense of identity also outside. I mean, what do I have? What do I do? What titles do I have? What are my credentials? And that is all impermanent. So we have no idea that our essence, what we really are, is inside of us, independent of anything outside, any achievement, any trauma, any past, any memory, or any expectation of the future. You know, the I represents, like, instead of looking, there's something inside of us looking out, and that's what we are, not the circumstances around us, not our life history, not our life situation, but this presence. And this presence is absolutely perfect, absolutely free. No, so we are slaves because of a confusion. We have this confusion of basing our identity in all these things that we are not.
Indeed. Youth start The Slave with, it's a story of a person without a name who's not quite sure if he's dead or alive. Tell us about this approach. I mean, I thought it was a fascinating approach.
Well, I wanted it to be an affirmation. If you read the book, it is you're reading it out loud or reading it in your mind, and you're making an affirmation about yourself. So the character is talking, and you are talking in your head at the same time. So when you read, "I am a slave to my past. I am a slave to my traumas," and then you say, "And now I decide to be free. And now I decide to take responsibility of my life. Now I know that I am the only one capable of solving whatever needs to be solved in my life." So the whole book, the character doesn't have a name because it is actually the reader. No, that was an idea I had, and I wanted it to be like a constant affirmation from the beginning to the end of the book.
Well, again, it's a fascinating approach. Because you're right, it sort of pulls you in a very different way. What you're reading, you find yourself feeling it, experiencing it in a much more personal way because there's no name. So, you know, we think of a name and then we all automatically attach things to the name. You don't really do that in The Slave. There's a time in your story where there is a conversation between this unnamed person who's in a coma, and he's talking to somebody. And initially, we're not really sure what's going on or who he's talking to. Tell us about that technique and what you wanted to accomplish.
Well, the thing is, I believe that we have a higher intelligence. It is an intelligence that is not separated from us, that is always there. And actually, I believe that we all know what to do with our lives, but we're distracted. We are not listening to this higher intelligence, that it is our own, our intuition, our subconscious. And we know right from wrong. We know what is productive and we know what is counterproductive. But we're distracted. So when we're distracted, instead of listening to this, what I call this guide inside our head, we react automatically with any kind of decision, no decision whatsoever between the event and our reaction. So what guide, it is this higher intelligence that we all have, that if we meditate, if we pay a little bit of attention, if we quiet our mind, we will be listening to it. Not in words, of course, because we need words to express it, but it will be an intuition of what is right for us. You know, when there is two kinds of, in the way I see it, there is two kinds of decisions that we make. One that comes out of our mind, our discursive mind, and that is full of doubts. What if I do this? What if I don't do this? What if I make a mistake? And there's another kind of decision that comes from a higher intelligence, and that one, it is precise. No, it is like there's no doubt. You absolutely know that is the right thing to do. So this character, the guide, represents this higher intelligence in all of us.
I want to move away from the book for a moment and get a better sense of Anand Dilwar.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come to this work that you do? How did you, were there people or events in your early life that started you on this path? Or just tell us about that.
Well, I need to tell you that The Slave is my book number 17. I have written a total of 33 books, and The Slave is the number 17. There was a transition in my life, a transformation in my life, and there was also transformation in my writing. I was very much interested in the cult of personality at first, self-improvement and all that area of study. But then I went into this transformation. I went into more spiritual approach in my self-development. And that's how I felt at one moment. You know, the slave, it's me, it's you, it's everyone. And we feel trapped in a life that we didn't choose. And in my life, I was like that, Pamela. Yeah, I had not a very easy childhood, like many of the readers, I guess, they share this same history. So when I was a teenager, I had a lot of problems. I did struggle with alcohol, with not drugs, I was lucky about that, but codependency and so many common things that we all have to deal with at one point in our lives. And that's how I felt. I felt paralyzed. I felt unable to solve my life. I felt completely useless. Not useless. What's the word in English? I felt completely helpless. I feel helpless.
Okay.
So that's the metaphor of this life. No, there's a point in our life if you blame whatever it is going wrong in your life in outside circumstances or in the past, then you are completely helpless. There's nothing for you to do. So my idea was to create this story, this metaphor of realizing this deeply and then do something about it to change my life, to take responsibility. And with responsibility comes freedom. If you're pointing outside for everything that is wrong, then your power is outside. It depends on others. When my brother changes, when my mother changes, then I will be okay. But if you point at yourself, then you have the power to decide. You have the power to change whatever is wrong. You have the power to make all the changes necessary. And it is like a kind of a miracle, because after this book, I managed to do that exactly.
You know, it's interesting as you describe yourself as a teenager which is exactly the place that so many teens are today, even as we speak, adults as well. But just the notion that as a teen, and we know that teens can feel very hopeless and very helpless and very lost, and that will often take them to almost unspeakable acts of self-harm and of harm towards others. And I'm curious as to how you, as that teenager, how you were able to pull yourself away from that very human experience, particularly as a teen, to really be able to look within at yourself.
Well, it didn't happen at my teen years. It happened a little bit later on when I was an adult. But it was thanks to my father. My father was always inspiring me to make myself responsible for whatever was going on in my life. I had a big struggle. I struggled with so many things in my life. There's I didn't have a very easy life. So, but there was always an understanding in me that every crisis in my life was an opportunity to learn. So I never lost hope. I never lost this intention of being okay no matter what. So I think that was the most important thing in my life, to see every single crisis, every single problem as a challenge to overcome.
Which is, again, it's such a critical shift in how many people think. I mean, we are certainly none of us responsible for what others do to us or around us, but we absolutely have choice about what we do with the circumstances in which we find ourselves.
Definitely, yes.
I want to move back to The Slave, a spiritual manifesto for a better way of life. And you talk, your character's guide points out to him that he is actually free to think whatever he wants to. He can think whatever he wants to. He can choose to feel however he chooses to feel. And indeed, no one has power over him. That's a pretty powerful concept. That's a pretty powerful lesson.
Yeah, we have to realize at one point that we are not our social conditioning. We are born in a society that gives us all of our beliefs. It gives us our sense of good and bad, our sense of beautiful and ugly. We have received from our society whatever we believe. So and from there, whatever we think, whatever we decide, and however we behave. But it is very simple to notice that different societies have different beliefs, different conditionings. So the way you think is actually not the way you are, is not your thinking, but the conditioning that you have received from your society, your religion, wherever you were born. North American has a way of seeing life, a cosmovision that is completely different from a Hindu, let's say, or from a Mexican, actually. So when you realize that, then you see that you have the responsibility, actually, to choose your beliefs, to choose those beliefs that serve you, those beliefs that go with whatever you want in life, and you are capable of choosing what beliefs you're going to keep because they support you in the way you want to be in the world, and what beliefs you're going to deny and forget about because they don't give you a beautiful way of life, a beautiful guide to behave.
Anand, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Anand Dilwar, creator of The Slave, a spiritual manifesto for a better way of life. Don't go away, folks. We'll return in just a moment. Said something very important that I'd like to truly underscore. You said we are not our social conditioning. And as you know, that is so often not what we recognize. We recognize ourselves as being that in which we have been born, what people say about us, tell us what we are supposed to believe, what we are supposed to aspire to or not. That is such a powerful reality that we are not our social conditioning.
Yeah, this is something that goes beyond this book, but we can talk about it also. Yeah, we have this confusion about being whatever we have learned in our life. We have been told how to be. We have been told what we are. We have been told what to believe in every single matter of life. You know, religion, spirituality, goals, and expectations, even values, and whatever we have, we're supposed to praise or reject. But we're not that. We're something beyond that. That is only the contents of our mind. This is one of the biggest problems that we face as humanity. We are identified completely with the contents of our mind, and that. The traditions call it the ego. The ego is form, but all the descriptions we made of ourselves, what we have learned, what we believe we know about us, but that is not us. And if we believe to be the ego, we believe to be our conditionings, we have a very narrow way of living. There is a script in our life, and we must follow the script, you know, saying, okay, I am North American, and I should behave this way. I am Mexican, I should behave this way. I am Hindu, I am Christian, I am this, I am that. And then that is a very narrow way of living life. Not only that, because we say, I am this. This is the way I am. And living like that, it is also a very limited way, because there is no space for spontaneity, for freshness, for joy. I mean, you react the very same way every time you face a situation. And in that way, you are repeating your past. If you believe that you are your history, you are doomed to repeat it. In your history, there's your destiny.
In your history, there is your destiny. You know, so many people are afraid. I mean, they're literally frightened of transitioning from the way that they see themselves today, as we speak, to something perhaps more open and more free and more powerful, as you describe. What do you say to those folks who are afraid to begin to shift how they think?
Well, we are all facing a transition as human beings. We have been completely fascinated by the form, by the content of the present moment. But we are beginning to understand that we are not that. We are the space in which in which everything happens. We are not our thoughts. We are not our beliefs. We are not our feelings. We are not our conditioning. We're something else. We're the space where everything happens. So, yeah, I think that's a humanity as a whole. We're facing this transition from basing our identity in everything that is surrounding us, our car, our job, our relationships, our house, and then realizing that we're not all that we have gathered. We're something else. We are the space where everything is happening. So it is scary because we have no references. I mean, we have always been taught that we are something else, something that we can describe. And then the transition is, you're not that. You are something else that it is undescribable. You are something else. You are the space that allows everything that to happen in your life. Sure, it's scary because we have no idea, but I think we are slowly transitioning to realizing it.
There is so much that's going on in the world today. I mean, in a lot of ways, it makes complete sense that the slave is such a popular and soothing, if you will, and thought-provoking mm-hmm. read, because there is so much negativity that we hear about in the world today. There's so much vitriol that seems to be a part of our daily lives. Do you think it sounds like you're really thinking that things are beginning to get better, however?
I listen to many authors and teachers and masters all over the world repeating this message that we need to awake. We are in crisis now. It is very easy to see how terrible things are around the world, and there is a very much an important need for a change. And when I see teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh, for example, this Zen monk with thousands of followers, I realize that there is something going on. I really realize that there is a shift in consciousness that is happening right now. You're familiar with the 100 monkey theory. Maybe we're reaching this mass consciousness that is going to create a huge change. That's my hope, because the other alternative is very scary.
For those who are not familiar with that theory, explain what you reference.
The 100 monkey, they say that there is an island, and then one monkey acquires an ability, like let's say wash his food before eating it, instead of eating it with all the dirt. Another monkey sees that behavior and repeats it. Another monkey sees that behavior and repeats it. And then when you reach 100 monkeys, their behavior is shared by the whole species. They don't need to see it. They don't need to experience or see someone doing it. The consciousness of that behavior jumps into every single individual in the community of in monkeys in this example. So the 100 monkey means about a critical mass of consciousness that will make a shift involving all the individuals of the species.
It's certainly a shift that I would suggest we need to experience yesterday, if not at least by tomorrow. But it doesn't quite happen that quickly, does it?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's very very slow. I'm afraid that we can read books, we can attend seminars, we can listen to our teachers for years, and then one day, finally, you get it. Oh, now I understand what my teacher wanted to say 20 years ago. It is very, very slow because that's the way consciousness is. It is not the same to learn something. You read a book and you learn a skill, you have knowledge. But then to be aware of something, to create consciousness, is a little bit more, is slower and harder, for sure. But what can we do? We keep going.
Well, that is true. We do keep going. And I have to suggest that, you know, with readings and offerings such as The Slave, it really reminds us that we should keep going, that we can keep going, that there really is a way to live and breathe in a more peaceful fashion.
Definitely, definitely. And now it is an option for all of us, you know. I really think that we are responsible for the change in consciousness that is much needed. Jiddu Krishnamurti, this Hindu philosopher, he said that there is one human consciousness. So whatever you do for your own consciousness, you're doing it for the whole. So that's really my hope, that if we keep working on ourselves, working on realizing that we are truly free, we're truly responsible for whatever is needed to be changed, then a change will happen.
The guide in The Slave, again, it's a very wise voice. And he says, this life is full of contradictions. We are born free, but we have to work to keep our freedom, and we have to accept responsibility for it. And that, I mean, we've been talking in that same vein throughout our conversation today, but, you know, I think that it's so important for us to really take hold of that concept. We are born free, but we have to work to keep our freedom. We have to accept responsibility for it. So many times we don't think that, we don't have that experience of ourselves, and we don't know what taking responsibility for it actually means.
Definitely, yeah. We need to work on our ability to pay attention. That's one main, very important ability that we have to work on, paying attention. If you pay attention to your present moment, if you're mindful, then you have the capability to choose. But if you are not mindful, I mean, if you are lost in thought, then you have no capability of choosing what you are, is reacting. There is an event and there is an automatic reaction, and that is not being free. Being free is having a space between the happening, the event in front of you, and then your reaction. You decide how to react. You're driving in your car, someone cuts you off, your usual reaction is to get very angry, blow the horn, and ruin your day. What if you work a little bit in your mindfulness, in being aware, to be present, to pay attention, and then you see this guy cutting off, and then you see your reaction? I mean, you may get angry, but then you don't have to react in an angry way. You can breathe, you can say, okay, take a couple of breaths, and let it go. So this is a very different approach. The first example, the guy reacting immediately, he's not free. He's just like a robot. You push a button, and then there's a reaction. The second example, I mean, the guy is breathing, and he's deciding not to react, not to ruin his day because someone made a mistake.
So you can, in fact, be a slave or a robot to your circumstances, or you can make very different choices.
That's right.
The thought that the reality that guilt is an excellent way of controlling people, again, mm-hmm. it's another concept that the guide shares in The Slave. People do a lot with guilt, and it's a very heavy, burdensome, powerful concept, experience, when you say it's an excellent way of controlling people, what do you want the listener to recognize about that?
I want them to recognize that guilt is always imposed on you. Guilt is not, in my point of view, guilt is not a natural emotion. All natural emotions like anger, happiness, sadness, they have a natural outlet. You get angry, well, then you do something with your body. You tense your fist. You may scream. You may do something, and then you release the anger. If there is sadness, then you cry. And then 5 minutes later, you feel much better because you have a release of this energy called sadness. Guilt is imposed. It is created by society or by religion or by someone that wants to control you. And then it has no natural outlet. If you feel guilty, how would you express it? You just feel guilty, and there's no outlet for that emotion and energy. So we must realize that whenever you feel guilt, you're wasting values, energy, and time. What I propose is to be very mindful about what you did. I mean, you made a mistake. You behave in an improper way. If there's something to do about it, then you do it. You apologize. You make amends. You do whatever you need to do. But if there is nothing to do, then you just learn about it and let it go, because if not, you're going to be hurting yourself indefinitely.
I do a lot of work with couples in which there has been some form of infidelity. And invariably, the partner who is experiences him or herself as the aggrieved partner wants the other one to feel guilty. Will say, you know, you did this thing, and you have violated my trust, and you don't even feel guilty. You don't even feel sorry for it. You just want to forget about it. What do you say in those situations?
Well, this wanting the other to feel guilty, it is a punishment. No, you want to punish the other. What do you want to suffer? You want the other to suffer because what he did to you, but that's exactly what the guilt does. That's exactly in a wrong way religion does, to manipulate people. Not in every case, but it is very common that they use guilt. They want to punish you for not behaving the way that they think that you're supposed to behave. And this is the same thing in a couple, you know, like, you're not supposed to do this, and I want you to suffer because you did it. So we need to realize that one thing it is to feel guilty, and one different thing it is to be responsible. You know, the partner who was unfaithful, he needs to acknowledge his responsibility and say, you know what, I am responsible for this, and make amends if it's possible, and make a commitment or renew the commitment of exclusivity. But guilt will not help.
And
none of them.
And in fact, it can become the third member of the marriage.
Yeah, that's right.
In not such a great, healthy way.
No, that's right. They say that resentment is a poison that you prepare every day for someone else, but you drink it yourself.
Indeed. Anand Dilwadar, we're going to take a break, and when we return, we will continue with the creator of The Slave, a spiritual manifesto for a better way of life. We'll be right back. Anon, there are so many things that happen with the in the slave. Can you tell us a little bit about the progression for your character in The Slave? Just a bit, not the whole piece.
not to spoil it.
Right.
Yeah, well, the character is very angry at first. I mean, he is not responsible at all. He is in that situation where he finds himself, and he will not make himself responsible. He will say, no, this is because of my childhood, all my traumas. It is not my fault. And then he has this conversation with this guy, this higher intelligence, and he starts, this guy is a little bit sarcastic. You notice that he's a little bit, he's got a sour sense of humor. But little by little, he goes on realizing that, that in fact, whatever happened to him and whatever is happening to him, it is his responsibility. So he stops blaming everyone. And at one point, he sees that he must stop blaming himself also. Like we just talked about it, guilt is useless, but he holds himself responsible for whatever is going on. And with this, he finds forgiveness. He finds forgiveness for everyone around. He finds forgiveness for himself and his parents, his girlfriend, everyone that surrounds him. With this forgiveness comes peace, and then with this peace comes an incredible appreciation of life. He's no longer able to enjoy all the beautiful things that he was able to enjoy, but not realizing it. And we are like that. You know, we are looking for miracles, but we want almost magic tricks. We want all these events that go against the law of nature. But if we pay attention and we are really, if we appreciate the miracle of life, then we see miracles everywhere. I mean, you see a flower with such a beauty, such a perfume, such a gift. You see your doggy, you get out of the house half an hour and then you come back and he's incredibly happy. It is such a miracle. And then you see yourself at the mirror, and then you will see the greatest miracle ever: your eyes, your heart beating, who knows why, your hands, your ears. I mean, everything in your life, it is a miracle. But we're looking for something. We have gotten used to this amazing miracle that it is existence, and that's what happens to the character in my book. I mean, he finds himself completely paralyzed, and he misses exactly what we all have every day: to touch our children, to talk to our beloved, to be able to walk, to cry, to smile. All this is a wonderful miracle, but we are distracted. We get used to it. We don't appreciate it anymore. And that's what he realized at the moment. And then I will not say the end of the book.
Fair enough. The idea that drugs and alcohol and certainly any number of the addictions that people struggle with, one of the things that it does, and it does many things that are not great, but one of the things that it does is it almost hides the miracle of everyday life from the person who's consuming in that way. It creates a cover through which you can't really see the truth of what's around you.
Definitely. Any addiction is an escape. We don't want to feel, so we escape in our addictions. We not only lose contact with reality, but we also lose contact with ourselves. If there is something that you don't want to feel, then you grab a cigarette or a piece of cake. Now it's so evident that we are addicted to our phones. It is a little bit terrifying to walk in the streets and see 90% of the people completely lost in our devices. So that's also an addiction. And yeah, instead of looking at the beautiful reality surrounding you, we are lost in our addictions. No, the phone, the Facebook, the internet, anything that we do compulsively, it is a way of escaping, and it is a way of losing the precious moment that is in front of you.
You spoke moments ago about the concept of forgiveness, and I know you know that that's a really challenging one for many people. Mm-hmm. There are many myths attached to forgiveness, and the idea that one should forgive and forget, that if you forgive somebody, you're letting them off the hook. All these things get in the way of one's ability to truly forgive. So spend a few moments, if you would, talking about your sense of what forgiveness actually means.
Sure. I really think that the forgiveness is not an action in itself. Forgiveness is the result of understanding. If you understand that your parents actually did the best they could with the level of consciousness they had, then what is there to forgive? You know, if you put yourself in their shoes and you know that they were so busy with their own traumas, with their own problems, with their own needs, then you will understand that there is nothing to forgive, and that's the case for everyone. Forgiveness, I think it is a gift that you give to yourself. And it is not that you forgive for the other person or for you forgive for yourself. You forgive and you give this this gift to you. So that's what I think that about. Forgiveness is not something about being good or there's you just said it. Forgive and forget. I think it is forgive and remember. You forgive. I mean, you remove the emotional attachment to the memory. You will remember it because you don't want it to happen again, or you want to be protected by whatever happened in that moment. But then you remove the emotional attachment, no? And then you can look back. Know that something went wrong, no, in let's say in your childhood, and then it's not that you condone the behavior, you just understand and let go of the hurt and let go of the anger and the resentment. We have a workshop in my center where we do childhood work. One of the exercises is to imagine your father and your mother carrying their own wounded children in their arms. That's so powerful because you see that they also had traumas. They also had a very difficult childhood. And then you feel so much compassion for them. And then you understand forgiveness comes by itself. And then the other thing that I want to say about that, it is you cannot force forgiveness. You have to do the work of understanding. And if there is some emotional work needed, you need to do it. In this workshop that I am talking about, we do a lot of anger release. Because sometimes you say, okay, I forgive you, but you're sitting in a volcano of anger. And then you're passive-aggressive to this person. You don't really forgive. You just say that you forgive, but you are, like, very angry. So there must be an emotional release of the anger. And then from there comes the understanding, and from the understanding comes forgiveness, real forgiveness.
So forgiveness is not something that you necessarily wake up tomorrow and say, okay, I forgive, and that's it. It is a process.
No, it is a process, definitely. You need to understand all the situations surrounding whatever happened, whatever was done to you. And then forgiveness comes. No. I mean, you wake up one day and you say, I'm going to forgive. Then you're giving this false forgiveness. You're sitting in a mountain of rage, and then you say, "I forgive you," and it is not real. No, it comes out as aggression later on.
The notion of forgiving oneself is sometimes harder to really conceptualize than the idea of forgiving someone else. What's your sense of how that is?
Definitely. We have this tendency to be very hard on ourselves. I thought it was only universal, but I was listening to an interview with the Dalai Lama. And the interviewer says to the Dalai Lama, how to deal with this self-loathing? And he will not get it. He will say, what? This self-hate that we all have. And he said, what do you mean? So it turns out in Tibet, they have too much self-love. They don't know so much self-loathing as we do. So that's another habit that we have. We have this belief that if we let go, if we accept ourselves, we will not be improving ourselves. We need to motivate somehow ourselves to be better by judging, by pushing, by criticizing. But it doesn't work. The truth is that it doesn't work. We do it all the time. We're always. I say to my friends that we are our worst enemies. We will not talk to anybody else the way we talk to ourselves in our head.
So true. So
true. You know,
true.
Nobody will put up with it. Right. We don't even do it to our enemies.
That's true.
But
That's very true. What we do to ourselves, if we were to do that to other people, we would be very much alone. We wouldn't have any friends.
We will not. We will be completely alone.
Another comment that is made in The Slave is the need to declare oneself free of all your wounds. Sounds like, again, you're talking about the process of self-forgiveness and self-acceptance.
Yes, and I am also talking about living in the now.
Okay.
We all have a history, but we are not our history. Whenever we want to, I ask somebody, why are you unhappy? Why are you so miserable? They have this pleasure in telling me all the reasons why. You know, they say, grab a chair and I will give you a coffee because I'm going to tell you all my sad, terrible story. We are completely identified with our stories. We don't know it, but we don't realize it, but we are very proud of our suffering, our traumas, our everything that we have been, we have suffered. So we need to break this identification with our history. Our history is very useful to understand us, but it is not useful if we want to justify us. You see, if it is okay to go to our history, understand what is it that happened, and then do something about it, but we'd use it to justify everything that is wrong. We say, What do you want me to do if this happened to me? There's a story about twin brothers that they have a father with a terrible problem with alcoholism. One turns out to be an alcoholic. The other one turns out to be an incredibly successful and healthy person. They are both asked, why? How come you become like that? And they would answer, what do you want it? With the father I had.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Anand Dilawar, author of The Slave, A Spiritual Manifesto for a Better Way of Life. How do people learn more about, you mentioned your center. Where is your center located?
My center is outside Mexico City, 2 hours away from Mexico City. The town is Valle de Bravo. I have a Facebook page they can visit. This is Anand Dilawar Official. It's actually in Spanish, but it's the same way in English. So an Andilbar official, that's where they can learn about my center and whatever I'm doing. And the slave has his own Facebook page, The Slave by an Andilbar.
And would you spell your name?
Sure. Let me write it down, because we in Spanish, we never spell. Anandilbar. A-N-A-N-D-D-I-L-V-A-R. Anandilbar.
So it's Anandilbar Official, and that's the Facebook page.
Yes. That's it.
Wonderful. Anand, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your wisdom with us here on Mind Talk.
Pamela, thank you so much for your interview. Thank you for your comments on my books. And I got a little bit nervous. This is my very first interview in English, so I apologize for all these
You have done an exceptional job. No one would ever know.
Wonderful.
Except now you've told them.
Great. Great.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is available to you daily on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from Apple or from Google Play. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to this edition of Mind Talk. So send an email to me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's myndtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.